From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Gary Lilly.
Good morning, America. And good morning to all you CBs out there in Port Hueneme, Gulfport, Mississippi, Iraq, Afghanistan, and all points around the world where you're supporting the troops of the United States Navy and Air Force, all the Marines. Good morning to you. We're going to have a show this morning, Bob, that's near and dear to my heart. We've got Bob Gould and Dale Thronberry in here.
Good morning.
That was Dale. Good morning, Bob.
Hello there, and all the 101st Airborne.
We're going to be going around talking later on to folks from the Seabees, Lara Godbill, who's the director of the U.S. Navy Seabee Museum, and Captain Bob Quinn, who served with the Seabees and several different units. I'll be introducing them later on. But right now, we've got Congressman Jones on the line, Walter B. Jones, and he's going to tell us about his efforts to redesignate the Department of the Navy as the Department of the Navy and Marine Corps. Good morning, Congressman.
Gary, good morning to you, Dale, and Bob, and I really appreciate this opportunity. It is a commitment that I made almost 6 years ago to, it's symbolic, I would be the first to admit, but it's important symbolism that the Marine Corps be seen as it is, and that is part of the team under the Department of Navy, Navy and Marine Corps.
Were you a Marine?
No, sir. I don't have a military background.
Really?
But I do have Camp Lejeune in my district. And I've been on the Armed Services Committee now for 7 terms, which is almost 14 years. And so many times when the Marine Corps and the Navy come to testify before the Armed Services Committee, all I hear from both is we're one fighting team. We're one fighting team. And to me, the Congress has spoken back in the 1948, I believe it was, and in the 80s, and they've said each and every time, we have 4 separate services, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps. And if you think about it, Gary, each one has a Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Navy, Secretary of the Air Force. Why shouldn't the Secretary of the Navy carry the name Marine Corps? Because, as they've said so many times, we're one fighting team. And I believe for the first time, and I want to thank Senator Levin. He was quoted in the Hill magazine about back in May, did an article on this bill, and he said, I'm open to the issue. That doesn't mean he's for it, but at least he's open to hear why this is needed. And, in fact, I'm meeting with him on the Thursday that we go back after Labor Day. And we got many congressmen from Michigan who support this legislation. Editorial a year ago in the Chicago Tribune, Step Up for the Marines. And that's what we're trying to do.
It's kind of interesting. As a former Seabee, I was in the history of the Seabees, I learned that the Navy tried to give the Seabees to the Marines after World War II when budgets were tight and the Marines said that they didn't want us. But I have a lot of the same feelings as the Marines have from the standpoint, I'm a Navy man, but I'm over and above that to me. I'm a Seabee. And so the Marines, there's probably a lot of people out there that don't understand that they're part of the Navy. They think they're Marines.
Well, the issue is they're sea services. I mean, that is, you know this because of your background in the military, that the Marine Corps and the Navy, they have long traditions. And it's just, I mean, I don't know if my staff sent it to you, but let me give one example. This Marine named Michael Bitts was killed in Iraq. His family received the Silver Star in his honor, and I was at that ceremony. And the orders from the Navy, it was the Department of Navy, Washington, D.C., with the Navy flag, nothing in the heading about the Marine Corps. So we took that letter and we devised it with the Marine flag, the Navy flag, across from each other, and Department of Navy Marine Corps. And I tell you, it really just gets your attention.
I saw that. Your staff did send that to me, and I responded that let there be no doubt that America is defended by the finest people in the world. and we've got to take care of these troops. But that healthcare is one of the
huge
things
issue.
Getting back to what you were saying, I did receive that, and it got me to thinking that yes, indeed, there's no prouder organization, I don't believe, than the Marines. I mean, I'm a CB. There's Air Force, Army, Navy out there, but I don't think any outfit in the world, you know, is more proud of their service.
Well, Gary, that's why I wanted to thank the Marine League, as well as those I won't call names, but in Michigan, who have really gotten behind this, and the Fleet Reserve Association has been very supportive. This, for the fifth year, we have sent this language, to redesignate the Department of Navy and Marine Corps in the House Armed Services Bill. It will be a conference item in late September, maybe October. And if Senator Levin, who's a fine gentleman, I have great respect for him, if the Senate would just say when we go to conference, we accept the House position, then it becomes a reality. And so I just want to thank any and everybody that might be listening. And if I could give the switchboard in Washington, D.C., if anybody feels passionately about this, as I do, that they could call the Senator's office, any Senator's office, at 202-224-3121. This is just, they've already changed the name. If you think about it, there was one time there was the War Department, which has changed. There was a United States Army Air Force at one time.
Right.
Change for the good, it should happen. And the first commandant of, the midshipmen at the Naval Academy, that's already taken place. They changed the name of the football stadium at Annapolis to be Navy and Marine Corps Stadium.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, sir. And there have been other changes, and this really doesn't cost any money. We have had former commandants, former Secretary of Defense to support this change. Even several admirals have supported this.
Congressman, we've got about a half a minute left, how the time flies.
Yes, sir.
There's a lot of former Marines out there, and I would imagine that if any of them knew about this issue, they'd be on that phone line.
Yes.
Which I'm going to repeat it again in a minute or so. But
yes, sir.
So all you Marines out there, get your pencil and paper handy. And how again did the idea come? How did it come to your attention?
Just because I have Camp Lejeune down in my district, and I think so many times that I've wondered, truthfully, why in the world weren't they represented in the name of the department and the name of the secretary?
Well,
they're an important part of the team. They are extremely. And why not have their name there with the Department of Navy?
Congressman, that's the final word on it. We appreciate your being on air with
Thank you, Gary.
Veterans Radio. And all you Marines out there, you're going to start calling 202-224-3121. And I'm going to
ask for their senator.
Thank
you. God bless you. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Congressman.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And, Bob, we've got some troops we're going to welcome home today.
Yes, I do. Welcome home. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who've been stationed around the world in the service of their country. First, Arizona Valley families welcome home Army Reservists, arriving by plane. 70 Army Reserve soldiers from the 164th Support Group landed at Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas. They then boarded buses for the trip to Mesa, Arizona. The group deployed to Iraq in July of 2006, where they supported the entire theater of operations with technical, tactical, and combat service support. The 164th is one of more than 170 Army Reserve units under command and control of the U.S. Army Reserve 63rd Regional Readiness Command in Arizona, Nevada, and California. Thank you, says the community. The Oregon National Guard's 41st Brigade Combat Team returned from a 16-month deployment in Afghanistan. Brigadier General Douglas Pritt told the crowd in T-Guard, Oregon, that the, and I quote, best-trained soldiers our nation has to offer were sent to a country that couldn't stand on its own, unquote. He then added, quote again, you give hope to an entire country, unquote. Looking at the parade and the turnout of local residents, one observer remarked, quote, We didn't have anything like that when we returned from Vietnam. After the ceremonies, every soldier was offered a bottle of, this is the name, Rogue Brewery beer. How about that? Were you given any beer when you got off the plane, Gary?
No, we got a lot of it in country, though. They had to keep the CBs working.
All right, I'll
Tiger
move
beer.
On from
Tiger
that
beer.
One.
All you guys that served over there will recognize the name Tiger Beer. Dale will tell you that.
The 13th Sustainment Troops come home. 60 soldiers from the 13th Sustainment Command Headquarters and the 4th Corps Material Management Center returned to Fort Hood, Texas from Iraq. Last on our list, and a little bit closer to our home here at our flagship station in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Jackson, Michigan. A Jackson, Michigan-based National Guard unit, the 170th Quartermaster Battalion, arrived home after serving 14 months in Kuwait. The soldiers spent 1 year in Kuwait for Operation Iraqi Freedom. Welcome Home is sponsored each week by the Marine Scholars Program of Ave Maria University.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
How many of you are suffering from some kind of chronic pain? If you are, then you're just one of millions of people our age who just live with it. I strongly suggest that you give Quantum Physical Therapy a call at 734-483-9200. Quantum Physical Therapy is a multifaceted facility providing cutting-edge conventional and alternative rehabilitation services. The highly qualified and friendly staff at Quantum are the movement experts and are committed to coming up with a specific solution for your specific problem. Whether it's pain, weakness, swelling, nerve injury, amputation, disease, or age-related morbidity, they can help you lead a productive life. Quantum Physical Therapy has two locations, one at 5417 Whitaker Road in Ypsilanti, and the other at 6180 Michigan Avenue in Saline. That's Quantum Physical Therapy, 734-483-9200, or on the web at www.qptherapy.com.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Hope all you folks out there are ready for the story of the Seabees, the Fighting Seabees. I was a member of that. I saw that movie by John Wayne, and I'll never forgive him because that's what got me to join the Seabees. Laura Godville, Director of the U.S. Navy CB Museum, and Captain Bob Quinn, CEC, Civil Engineer Corps, United States Navy retired. Captain Quinn served with MCB 11, MCB 40, 30th Naval Construction Regiment, and 32nd Naval Construction Regiment. Laura and Captain Quinn, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Gary.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
It's my pleasure. I'm excited about this. You know what? I was doing a little research for this show, and I didn't realize how much we did. You guys kept us too busy. Laura, you're a director of the U.S. Navy CB Museum. Tell us a little bit about it, where it's located, and I understand you need some funding. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Actually, we are building a new facility. The U.S. Navy CB Museum is one of 12 official Navy museums. We're located in Port Hueneme, California, which is approximately 70 miles north of Los Angeles. And the reason that we're there is Port Hueneme has historically been the home port of the Pacific Seabees. And the Seabees have actually been home ported out of there since 1942 when they were created. The museum itself has actually been open since after World War II. The reason the museum opened is as Seabees came back from the Pacific, they brought home a lot of stuff, as Seabees like to bring home stuff.
Did it myself.
We basically had the Seabees had so much stuff there that they decided to open a museum. Right now, we're housed in a building that consists of some elephant Quonset huts that were actually built during World War II as temporary structures. Over the years, they've added on some different pieces, some different Butler buildings. It's kind of an interesting menagerie of construction, which in itself really speaks to the Seabee legacy. However, the CEC Seabee Historical Foundation, of which Captain Quinn is a board member, is doing a capital fundraising campaign to build us a new museum, which hopefully will open in March of 2010.
We're going to give a website or whatever later on, and for all of you former Seabees out there that want to donate, and you don't have to be a former Seabee, how about the Marines and the Army that we supported? If you guys want to donate to our museum, we'd love to have your money. Who can tell us, who wants to take on the task of telling us about the formation of the Seabees? Captain Quinn, were you, to have some familiarity with it, I would imagine.
I wasn't there, Gary, when the Seabees were formed, but...
Lara, you lied to me.
I was alive, but I wasn't quite old enough to be a Seabee.
I was alive, too.
The Seabees were formed in 1942 because just prior to World War II, the Army and the Navy recognized that sooner or later we were going to go to war with Japan. And they looked at the Pacific and figured out that we had no bases west of Pearl Harbor, and there was no way to successfully prosecute a war without supply bases and staging bases. And the folks in Washington, led primarily by Admiral Ben Morrell, who's the father of the Seabees, were able to convince Congress that we needed some bases in the Western Pacific to defend our own country. And actually, in 1939, they got approval to award a contract. It was called the Pacific Air Bases Contract. And when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, there were about 70,000 civilian construction workers scattered across the Pacific starting to build bases in anticipation of future need. Once the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and the U.S. declared war on Japan, in accordance with the Geneva Convention, the civilian contract construction workers couldn't be left in a war zone if they tried to defend themselves, since they weren't part of the uniformed military. They could be shot as spies and saboteurs. So we had to pull those people back, and we got most of them back. Most of us who watch late-night TV know about the folks on Wake Island, where the Marines and those civilian construction workers we did not get back. And they were either killed on the island or taken prisoners back to Japan. So Admiral Morrell went to the Navy and the Congress and said, I need to take those same kinds of experienced civilian construction workers, put them in uniform, put them in the Navy, make them covered by the Geneva Convention, and send them right back. So that's why we have Seabees. That request was approved, and if you think about the timeline, on December 7th, Pearl Harbor was bombed. That request was approved. Folks were found, some initial training given to them, and the first group of Seabees were actually sent to Bora Bora on January 21st, 1942.
Well, it doesn't take Seabees long to get things going.
No,
we all know that.
What's amazing to me is they were able to get the Congress and the rest of the Navy to move in such speed.
Different times, there was a crisis at hand, to say it mildly. Lara, what was the average age of the Seabees back in World War II?
The average age of Seabees in World War II was actually 37, which really is considerably older than even other troops during World War II. And the reason is, as Bob mentioned, they actually used a lot of these the people who had already been deployed out to the Pacific as civilian contractors. These were the same men who had worked on the large construction projects at home for the WPA, like the Triborough Bridge, the Hoover Dam. So these people already had training, which is why they were considered older soldiers.
And I thought about that quite often. In order to have an average age of 37, and you've got a lot of kids in there at 18, you've got to have a lot of people that are a lot older than that. And I understand there were people actually in their 60s that belonged to the Seabees in World War II.
Most definitely. At the museum, we have a rather extensive archive where we have all of the operational records of the Seabees. And it's interesting to go through because we have the muster rolls so you can see exactly how old people were. And there were truly Seabees who were in their 60s who were just joining the Navy.
I could not imagine going to war at the age of 60 or above. I'm 66 myself right now, and I'm tired.
That's the trouble with you kids.
Thanks, Captain. I love it. Give me an example, Captain, of one of the most notable accomplishments of the Seabees in World War II.
Well, just the fact that they kept building bases. We'd build a base, the Marines and the Army and the Army Air Corps would use that base to stage and then move to the next island, and the Seabees were typically right behind the Marines. Certainly they were very involved in Guadalcanal, one of the early battles, one of the more storied battles, keeping that airfield open to help the Marines survive and take the island. But probably one of the most unusual things is the huge runway complex on the north end of Tinian Island, where the Seabees built what at that time, and probably even today, was the largest airfield in the world, with five parallel runways from which the B-29s were able to take off, fly to Japan, and actually start bombing Japan. That's where the first and second atomic bombs were sent. The bomb turned out to be so large that they couldn't fit it under the airplane. So the Seabees had to literally build a pit that they could taxi the airplane over after they put the bomb down in the pit and then lift the bomb up into the Enola Gay and take it off. So
the
Seabees were doing all sorts of things in support of those who were actually fighting the war.
I didn't realize that there were five runways there. About 2 years ago on Veterans Radio, we had Captain or Major Dutch Van Kirk, who was the navigator of the Enola Gay, and he told about how they had to taxi over that pit to get the bomb up there. So I also had a personal conversation, a lot of them, with a local Ann Arbor man named Joe Rodriguez. He was in the squad that raised the flag, the famous flag raising on Mount Suribachi. And he told about looking down from Mount Suribachi and watching the Seabees repairing and expanding the Japanese runway. And he was watching when the very first B-29 came in that was crippled. And they had to get the dozers off the runway real quick while this thing pancaked. And the B-29 crew had to actually leave the plane under fire from the Japanese at the other end of the airstrip. All that time, the Seabees were out on the airstrip building it when the Japanese held the far end of it.
Well, I think that's pretty typical island after island. Of course, things like Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima are the more famous, but that sort of thing happened time after time. Certainly that Seabee, the movie you mentioned, John Wayne and the Fighting Seabee, showed much of that. And a lot of people think, well, that's just Hollywood, but that movie is truer than a lot of folks recognize, that those Seabees were gung-ho folks, and their goal was, let's get this war over with, let's get this stuff built so we can go home.
Well, we're going to get to Vietnam a little later, Captain. I know you served over there. I was with MCB3 in 1966. There was one time we were building a small base for the Marines on a place we called Hill 35, We broke for lunch one day and noticed some Marines working over a ridge about 150 yards over. And I asked the passing Marine what was going on there. He said, well, we've been taking sniper fire all morning. He's, you guys didn't hear it because you're making so much noise, but they're cleaning the snipers out over there. And so, yes, indeed, those things did. They went on not just in World War II, but elsewhere. Lara, you've got a lot of artifacts there in the museum, and I know you'll know a lot about the history of it, but I found it very interesting, again, that the first decorated CB was a guy named Lawrence Bucky Meyer on Guadalcanal. He found a abandoned machine gun and salvaged parts and repaired it and put it together and shot down a Japanese Zero that was making a strafing run.
Mm-hmm.
That's something, that's CB ingenuity, and you must have a lot of examples of it in the museum.
I think that CBs in a lot of ways are most famous for their ingenuity. During World War II, because of where they were deployed, namely the Pacific, where there weren't Home Depots, they didn't have a lot of supplies, they really had to make do with whatever materials they had around. So, for example, when they were doing electrical work on some of these Pacific islands, they didn't have the insulator caps to actually string up the wire. But instead, they used Coca-Cola bottles, because obviously they had those. We have another example of a handmade windmill laundry washer, because obviously they didn't have lots of uniforms. They had to stay clothed. And so they actually designed a wind-powered washing machine so that they could do their clothes rather quickly while they were still doing construction, so they could keep the war effort moving.
We also had CBs over in the Atlantic Theater, over into the European Theater.
Most definitely. About 85% were in the Pacific, but the other 15% served in Atlantic Theater, including North Africa, which is something that's often overlooked. Probably the most significant aspect of CBs in the Atlantic Theater was their assistance at the invasion of Normandy. One of the things that CBs did was they built all the causeways to help the army get the troops and the supplies ashore from the larger ships.
I also read about the teams that were in on Normandy beaches destroying the anti-tank traps and things of that nature, the obstructions. And when daylight came, the Germans saw them, and they came under intense fire, and a lot of the entire crews were wiped out when the fire hit their demolitions and set them off prematurely, killing the team. But these guys kept right on working, clearing the beaches so that our troops could get ashore at Normandy.
Yes, CB served with the underwater demolition teams that were engaged in that type of activity. Currently, I mean, if you look at this historically, the underwater demolition teams, the UDTs, ultimately became what's now the U.S. Navy SEALs. However, CBs still have underwater construction teams that do a lot of, they do more construction of piers, they do underwater research, more that type of thing. They're not so much into the very stealthy black ops.
Well, we know about the bridges and the piers and everything else that's built, and it all starts below water. Some years ago, there was an airplane hijacked during the Reagan administration, and one military man was killed by the hijackers, and that was a CB, I understand, one of the divers.
Yes, Robert Dean Steedham. He was the TWA flight, I think it's 85, was hijacked to Beirut. And unfortunately, the hijackers found out that he was part of the armed services, and he was murdered. But he had been serving with the underwater construction team.
I told my nephew that even in peacetime, the military is a very dangerous occupation. And that is an example of it. Tell us, we've got about a minute left. Tell us a little bit about the Iwo Jima and Okinawa, if you would, please, Captain Quinn.
Well, Iwo Jima, of course, was one of the most deadly battles that we fought. The island didn't have a whole lot of space, And the Seabees were involved there, like at everywhere else, to try to help. Unfortunately, there was a communications mix-up, and the Seabees actually wound up with the initial Marine invasion force. So Iwo Jima, we had the most casualties of any construction unit. But they did get ashore. They did help get the Marines inland and get the runways and other support facilities operating. Okinawa, of course, was probably the biggest.
Let's get back to Okinawa. We're going to be going to a break right now, so hang on there. And you are listening to Veterans Radio on a CB Can-Do Day.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Second Lieutenant Darwin Kyle charged an enemy emplacement, single-handedly killing the three enemy soldiers. Details after this.
The first job you choose in life could make or break your future. Making that decision takes facts. Here's a fact. The U.S. Air Force offers valuable training, higher education, medical care, and experience. So when it's time to choose your career, check out the Air Force. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
When his platoon had been pinned down by intense fire, Kyle completely exposed himself to move among and encourage his men to continue the advance against North Korean forces strongly entrenched on Hill 185. Inspired by his courageous leadership, the platoon resumed the advance, but was again pinned down when an enemy machine gun opened fire, wounding six of the men. Kyle immediately charged the hostile emplacement alone, engaged the crew in hand-to-hand combat, killing all three. Continuing on toward the objective, his platoon suddenly received an intense automatic weapons fire from a well-concealed hostile position on its right flank. Again leading his men in a daring bayonet charge against this position, firing his carbine and throwing grenades, Kyle personally destroyed four of the enemy before he was killed by a burst from an enemy submachine gun.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Len Pitlack, CPA, is an award-winning consultant for the U.S. Small Business Development Center. Let him use his 25 years' experience to bring you, as an individual or small business owner, his professional and courteous tax and accounting services. Give Len Pitlack a call today at 734-993-1313.
Schrader Yacht Sales, the East Coast's finest dealer of Chris Craft, Island Packet Yachts, Packet Craft, Parker Fishing Boats, and Nautic Star Boats. Schrader Yachts is located at the top of Barnicot Bay in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Our good friend Ray Schrader provides you, the customer, with over 30 years' experience in boat sales, sail and power boats, both new and used. Schrader Yacht Sales offers a full-service storage facility and a reliable crew responsible for all of your boating needs. Specialists in electronics, they can accommodate your needs for radar, autopilot, air conditioning, GPS, heat, and communications. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. That's 732-899-8010, or go to SchraderYachts.com. That's SchraderYachts.com. Oh, by the way, tell Ray you heard about him on Veterans Radio, and he will personally deliver your new boat from Schrader Yachts anywhere there's water. Schrader Yachts, ready to serve all of your boating needs.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Welcome back. And we're talking about the Seabees today. I'm Gary Lilly, MCB3, July 1966. We have with us Lara Godbill, Director of the U.S. Navy Seabee Museum, and Captain Bob Quinn, U.S. Navy retired, who served with the Seabees. Lara, I forgot to ask. You are a member of the military, are you not?
No, sir. I'm a civilian.
You're a civilian. Okay. That's why I didn't have it here. You know, we miss a point every now and then. We do our Medal of Honor series, and today I thought about it last night, and I asked, are we doing the CB? And we didn't, but I do want to mention that in 1965, a CB did receive the Medal of Honor, that would be construction mechanic third class Marvin G. Shields, U.S. Navy. He was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor for conspicuous gallantry in an operation at, where was it, Dong Xoai, 55
right.
miles northeast of Saigon. I remember when the battle happened. And over there, at the is it still there, Lara? They had one of the metal containers, the with Connex boxes, that was just riddled with shrapnel from that battle.
We still have it.
All right. And Marvin Shields has had a ship named after him, and we congratulate his family on having such a fine, brave man that was awarded the Medal of Honor when he was supposed to be repairing trucks. Let's finish up with Okinawa, Captain, and we'll move on to the Korean War and to between the wars and to Vietnam, and then what's going on today. CBs are busy. What happened at Okinawa?
Well, Okinawa was one of the largest battles and the first time that the U.S. and Allied forces were actually landing on Japanese territory. The invasion itself wasn't terribly contested. The Japanese did not defend right at the beach as they did on most islands. The general there decided to pull his forces back and build into a ridge line all kinds of tunnels and caves and defenses. The Seabees were there in large numbers. Of course, Okinawa is a very large island and had a number of airfields. The same sort of thing that happened from the very early days, island after island. Seabees were involved in supporting the Army and the Marines, clearing roads, building bridges, getting airfields started for them, building housing, to get them out of the mud and get them a chance to get a good meal and dry off once in a while, ammo storage, fuel storage.
Captain, when I was joined Vietnam Veterans of America, I was talking to a former Marine, and I happened to have our cruise book, which is sort of like a high school yearbook to all the people that have not been in the Navy. And I read to him the things that we built, and he said, is that what the Seabees did in Vietnam? I said, no, that's what my battalion did on our deployment. And he said, God, no wonder you guys retired when you came back. Let's go on to the Korean War. That's the forgotten war, which we have not forgotten. And I honor all of those who served in Korea. And South Korea is free today, thanks to our troops that served there during the Korean War. One of the big feats, are you familiar with it, Laura? What was it, an island called Yeo in the Bay of Wonsan, where they needed an airstrip?
Yes, they built an emergency airstrip more or less in just a couple of days so that the airplanes could land. Unfortunately, as planes were flying into North Korea, they were running out of fuel and they were crashing just because they couldn't land, and so the Seabees built an airstrip very quickly.
That was a 2,400-foot airstrip. They built it in 16 days, and it sounds real familiar to me because we did a very similar thing in Chulai with the crosswind runway. I'll come back to that later. But the between the Korean War and the Vietnam War, there was many amazing things that the Seabees did, one of them being Operation Deep Freeze down there in the Antarctic. Captain, are you familiar with that?
Yes, typically you got to remember it's only 6:30 in the morning, and us old guys have trouble getting all the brain cells operating at this hour.
I forgot you guys are out there. You got up early for this show.
Oh yeah, it's worth it. Anything to support the Seabees and those folks who are helping to defend our country around the world. We're glad to do it.
Absolutely.
The Seabees were the construction force and also the maintenance and operating forces that supported the National Science Foundation for about 40-some years. Laura can probably remember the exact dates, but initially started on the East Coast. They operated out of Davisville, Rhode Island, and Quonset Point, Rhode Island. Eventually, it moved out to Port Hueneme, California, and the bases at McMurdo, at the South Pole, all of the bases that our scientists needed were actually built by Seabees. Then during the winter, the Seabees would remain there. They called it wintering over, and they're the ones who provided the heat, the electricity, the water, all of the support facilities that were needed. One of the most unusual things, we did build and operate a nuclear power plant at McMurdo. Years later, it was determined that it was not economical to continue it, and so that whole plant was disassembled and brought back.
But if you ever need a nuclear power plant, you can call. You don't have to call in Bechtel. Just call in the United States Navy Seabees. We can get it done.
We'll put it in overnight.
not over the winter? Gee, what does it get down there? What is the temperature down there?
Well, that's one spot I didn't personally get to, but it gets awfully cold.
I had friends down there, and they talked about these conditions.
My brother also was a CEC officer, and he did do construction with the Seabees at the South Pole.
Some of the guys I served with were down there. We've got a caller on the air. I think he has a question. Bob, could you put him through? That's coming up. And then we're going to get back to Subi Point. Is our caller on the air? Never mind. Well, not just yet. How about Subi Point, the Naval Air Station? That was a
Air Station at Subic Bay.
Subic Bay. Who am I speaking to here?
I'm Richard Munns.
I don't know. Well, if nobody else is on, I'll go ahead and answer.
Captain, can you hold on a moment? We do have the guest on the air right now,
Good.
Richard Munns.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, who are you with?
I was with Mobile Construction Battalion 3, the same one that Gary was with, but I was in there in 1955, 56.
Did I meet you at one of the reunions?
Well, I probably will. I don't know. My wife is totally blind, so I don't get to travel as much as I used to.
All right. So you were with my old outfit, MCB3.
Yeah, right.
What did you do?
I was a utilitiesman. I helped put in the pipelines, run the boilers for the asphalt plants.
Where was that?
In the Philippines.
In the Philippines.
You
were part of that
Naval
operation?
Air Station, Cuba Point, when we built that large naval station.
Well, Captain and Laura, I don't know if you can hear because of the on-air conversation we got going. I was going to bring that up. Mr. Munns, give me just a moment because I want to tell the audience about that.
Okay.
Here was a project that was a bigger earth-moving project than the digging of the Panama Canal. The Navy needed an airstrip over there at QB Point, and there was no place to put it, so they cleared the 6 and 8 foot diameter mahogany trees off the top of a mountain, took the mountain and pushed it out to sea, and there we had an airstrip. Civilian contractors said it couldn't be done, and the Seabees got it done in 5 years, and you were part of it, right? Mr. Munn?
Yes.
You were part of that project?
I was part of that project.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, basically, we had to cut a mountain down and fill in part of the bay to build the air station. I was involved in pipeline work and running the asphalt plant for the asphalt.
I don't know if we cut you off or not. Well, we lost Mr. Munn.
Oh, I'm still here.
Oh, okay.
I did pipeline work for the POL farm, the fuel farm that supplied the base. And then we were involved in the housing project and barracks building.
How many days a week did you work?
Beg your pardon?
How many days a week did you work?
We worked basically 7 days a week.
How many hours a day?
It run 10 to 14 hours a day.
Sounds like a CB to me. Okay. Hey, Mr. Munn, I appreciate your calling in. We're going to get back with Captain Quinn and Laura Godbill, and thanks again, and hope to hear you on the radio again.
Okay.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
You too. Captain, you're pretty familiar with Cuba Point. I never knew how to pronounce that. I wasn't there.
Yeah, Cuba Point's the most common pronunciation.
Okay.
And you pretty well summarized. It was a huge earth-moving project. We did wind up developing a major airfield to complement all of the other Navy facilities in Subic Bay area. And that whole facility has been turned back to the Philippine government, and it's now a major port and a major resort area. So that airfield that the Seabees built that others said couldn't be done is still in use.
We're coming back to that. We've got to go to a break right now, and you're on Veterans Radio.
Gary Lilly & Associates is now Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates, the newest Michigan affiliate of a leader in the commercial real estate industry, Sperry Van Ness. More than 800 Sperry Van Ness advisors in 136 markets sold nearly $11 billion in commercial real estate last year. That was done by putting the client's interest first, thereby generating maximum return for every property. When we list a property, we immediately place it on 6 internet commercial listing services and email it to 40,000 prospective buyers and 60,000 commercial brokers. We offer to split the commission 50-50. That means your interests, not ours, are placed first. To learn more, call Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates Commercial Realtors at 800-345-6694. That's 800-345-6694. Be advised, there is a difference.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And you're back on Veterans Radio on Ave Maria Radio with Captain Bob Quinn and Lara, U.S. Navy retired Seabee, and Laura Godbill, who's director of the U.S. Navy Seabee Museum, and we have Brant Houston, who served with MCB-1. Good morning, Brant.
Good morning.
When were you in MCB-1?
December of 1970 to... December 1974.
That's Mobile Construction Battalion 1, in case people wonder what MCB stands for.
First and the finest.
You guys were right up there, real close to MCB-3, weren't you?
We were.
our motto was better than best.
That's
so
right.
We got you topped. Hey, Brant, where did you serve and what did you do?
Well, you know, in 71, we were involved in Vietnam, and of course, they sent a bunch of us to a little island in the Indian Ocean called Dago Garcia. And we thought that they had lost their mind because they used to joke on C-130s when they were taking us there that if they missed the island, there wouldn't be enough gas in the plane to get us back to Thailand. But now with all that's going on in Iraq and everything, it gives me quite a bit of pride to see that island and how it come into to play, both the submarine base there and especially the airstrip. We couldn't believe how thick they wanted that concrete and the coral that we blasted and everything to make that runway. And that's where they're running the bombers out of.
Right.
There.
Don't give the thickness of it. I was told a long time ago when I mentioned the thickness of a runway at Lemoore that that's the military secret.
That's right.
Okay, so we won't talk specs on here.
No.
But, you know, this is good timing because I was about to bring up Diego Garcia because that was a bigger project than Cuby Point.
Yes.
And Cuby Point topped the Panama Canal, and now the Seabees have topped Cuby Point with Diego Garcia, which is critical, was critical in the first Gulf War and is critical now in the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
What did you say you did there?
I was equipment operator and worked in the blasting operation. We blasted the coral, to make the runway, right. And then
tell me what kind of days you worked. How many days a week and how many hours?
7 days a week, 10, 14 hours a day. We made, there was nothing on that island except donkeys, and so we had to make our own living quarters. First of all,
sure.
We stayed in tents until we got our hooches built, and then
did that over in Shulai.
Yep.
But, Brant, thanks for calling in and representing MCB1.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
Bye.
Can do. Captain Quinn, can you comment a little bit on Diego Garcia?
Yes, sir. As Brant mentioned, a little sand spit out in the middle of the Indian Ocean. It's about 1,500 miles from south of India and 1,500 miles west of the Singapore and 1,500 miles east of Africa. It's really out in the middle of nowhere. And though the Seabees did probably more work there than we did at Cuby Point, it was a different kind of work because there wasn't a mountain to move around. As Brant mentioned, on all the Pacific islands, the only real material you had to work with was coral.
The environmentalists are cringing right now.
Have to blast those coral reefs to create material that you could use to build the runways, and that is now a very large complex. The runway supports our operations throughout that part of the world. In addition, in the harbor, we have a bunch of pre-positioned ships that have all of the equipment for a Marine regiment and a CB battalion, so that whenever the nation needs those forces, the equipment and material they need is already halfway to the new job site.
It's an amazing thing. We even as a CB, I'd hear the names of places where we had people in it. You know, like, where in the heck is that? And Diego Garcia is another one, and I didn't realize that it was basically uninhabited before we got there. It is a huge base now. I want to bring up just one little thing about Vietnam. When I served there with MCB3 in Chu Lai, we were putting in the 82-hour work weeks, and that was after they gave us Sunday afternoons off. Up to then, we worked a long work week. But they worked us awfully hard, and one day they called us into formation, and, you know, nothing ever good comes out of that. And they said, okay, you're working pretty hard, but the Marines need a crosswind runway, 3,500-foot reinforced concrete runway. You got to drain a little bit of a swamp to do it. And you've got 30 days, the month of September, to do it before the monsoons hit. And, oh, by the way, everything that's got you working 82-hour weeks has to be completed and completed on time. You were an officer. How in the heck did we ever do those things? Because I always, we worked hard, but also at the same time, I admired the planning that went into it. How did we do it, Captain?
I think, again, it's the generations of Seabees have always bought into that can-do spirit of those older folks who were the original Seabees. And what's that strange saying we say about the, you know, the difficult we do immediately, the impossible takes a little bit longer.
And I learned that firsthand.
And for some strange reason, the entire force believes that. And I think we all kind of take it as a personal challenge that though it might sound impossible, if there's any way on earth to do it, we're going to get it done.
You know, I fell in love with the American people in Vietnam, believe it or not, because there was a lot of complaining and, you know, but when it got right down to it, the worse things got, the funnier people got. And I had some of my biggest laughs when we were building that Chu Lai airstrip. I worked the 12 or 6 at night to 6 in the morning shift, and we got mortared in the middle of it. And the mortars weren't coming down on us directly, but, you know, I took cover inside the culvert and the concrete culvert that we were building, and I thought, no, if it gets hit, I'm going to be buried under concrete. I'll take my chances outside. I ran back out and stopped in astonishment. I was the only one that took cover. Everybody was looking up in the air with irritated and a little bit concerned looks on their faces, but more of the looks on their faces said, this is a stupid time to mortar. We can't have a cold join on this concrete. Don't they know anything about concrete? I'll never forget it as long as I live. You know, guys looking up in the blackness of the night where the mortar rounds would be coming down and still working the concrete. The crane operator still operating the crane and the driver sitting in their cabs with one foot on the running board. Everybody looking up in the air and continuing to work. That's can do.
That is very Seabee.
That's very Seabee. I'll never forget. It's astounding to me. I still shake my head in disbelief over that.
Another example of that kind of thing, we had just opened a quarry just inland from the city of Wei, and it was out in the middle of enemy territory, and had a Marine unit that was providing security, and the Marines just about had epilepsy, as we needed the rocks, and so we ran the quarry 24 hours a day with floodlights all over the place, and they said, you know, you idiots are out here, you got your unit floodlit, there's no way we can protect you, you've created what amounts to a big bullseye for all the North Vietnamese, and we said, well, we need the rock, got to go. The Marines stayed with us, but we knew it was worse for them than it was for us.
Absolutely.
Those lights were silhouetting them in their defensive positions.
When we were building the airstrip, we told the Marines that were protecting us, hey, you guys can come in for hot chow about midnight if you want to. First night, they wouldn't do it. The second night, they came in like deer coming in under the lights to, you know, feed on the... We let them cut in ahead of us so that they could get back out there again. And I asked the Marine that cut in ahead of me, how can you guys wander around out there in the dark? He said, how can you guys work under lights? Well, I guess it's what you're used to.
Yep, just a little different mindset.
We've got about a minute and 44 seconds left, and I want to start the wrapping up. Let's talk about these Seabees today. They are good. They are very good. Captain?
Well, no question they're good. In fact, I look at the young kids, and I have the good fortune of being living here just outside the Seabee base, and they're smarter. They work as hard or harder than we did. We thought we were good. These new young folks are amazing.
Yep.
We have a couple of thousand of them scattered across Iraq, Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, and lots of other places that you don't hear about. We hear on the press periodically that, folks are going back the second time. This is terrible. Most of the CB units are going on their third and fourth trip. Their morale is amazing, and I don't hear any of them complaining. They think what they're doing is important, and they're ready and willing to go back, and they're doing the same things there that their predecessors did in World War II and Korea and everywhere else.
Captain, thank you so much. Larry Godbill, I wish we could have had more time to have you on telling us more about the museum, but I sure appreciate your being on here. Captain Quinn, thank you so much. I want to thank the sponsors before we close. Sperry Van Ness Lillian Associates, that's me, Quantum Physical Therapy, Len Pitlack CPA, Trader Yacht Sales, Legal Help for Veterans, the Marine Scholars Fund. And folks, please support our sponsors that keeps Veterans Radio on the air. And thanks for being with us. Come back next week. This is Veterans Radio on Ave Maria Radio. You are out.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of our guests and are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.